This is the infinite inning, the frame of the game with no beginning and no end. You don't know how you pitched your way in here. You don't know how you'll hit your way out. Or is that vice versa? All you know is, you can no more catch a break than you can the fly balls that keep sailing over the wall. Oddly, the spectators catch them. They always catch them cleanly. They make shoestring catches, diving catches, tumbling circus catches, over-the-shoulder catches. You watch. You wait. Here comes another one. You line it up. Whoops. E9. Runner on third. He's an overweight catcher with asthma. He last hit a triple in the Little League of Never. Will he score? Maybe. Possibly. I can't tell you. You want closure? I don't believe in closure. This is the infinite inning. By definition, it lacks closure. Last week was a dire news week, so I wanted to find an unequivocally happy story to tell you. Tell it, laugh a little, and then maybe play the now disavowed Ewok dance and move on. But here's the truth. For me, happiness is not a dance, but an inquiry into values. I'm weird. That's just what I get off on. So here's a story about a walk-off home run, which I originally meant to just be that happy doing cartwheels around the bases story, but it lends itself to another message. Appropriately, for the infinite inning, it's the journey to the walk-off, not the destination, that matters. Again, it's the infinite inning. The destination is always out there, just ahead, but it never arrives. You never even see it in the headlights. And there's a reason for that. For the participants in the stories, everything we go through is a path to a door, but I guess you can choose not to walk through it. One of baseball's historic great idiots was shortstop, manager, general manager, American League president, and Hall of Famer Joe Cronin. In this world, there are certain people who just get to fail ever upward. Not that Cronin failed at everything. He was a very good hitter for a shortstop of his day. That he went through periods where he had to field grounders from his knees, which, you know, even Derek Jeter, with his lack of range, did not hobble after balls. That compromises even his playing career, but hey, it was a brief period. His life, though, is a story for another day, and when I tell it, I'll ask Mark Armour to come on here. He wrote a full biography of Cronin, which is quite good, and maybe he'll debate the point with me. But here we are in 1937, when he was manager of the Boston Red Sox. The Sox had been miserable for a long, long time, but the 37 team wasn't too bad at 80-72. I know that doesn't sound like much, but it was their best record since 1918. Owner Tom Yawkey, who was about 4 years in to his long, long ownership of that team, had thrown a lot of cash at Connie Mack, so the Red Sox now had Jimmy Fox and Lefty Grove. Bobby Doerr was only 19, but he was already in the majors, and they were getting good performances from outfielder Ben Chapman and Pinky Higgins, who are both remembered today as racist bastards, and correctly so, but they played very well that year. In fact, they were both very good players overall, not superstars or anything, but very good. And to anyone in any walk of life who's around today, they should remember Ben Chapman and Pinky Higgins, not because racists are bad, which they are as evil can be. That's not the point, though. It's that the evils that men do live on after them, while their 300 averages are oft interred with their bones. No one will remember all the good things you do if you do one bad thing. And that's a lot of pressure, but it's true. On September 8th, 1937, the Red Sox were in New York to play the Yankees. The game was moot, more or less. The Yankees were 12 games up on the league with 28 to play. It's very hard to blow that. The Sox were 19 and a half games back. That's not something you can fix at that date of the season, if ever. The Yankees were then in year two of what would be four championships in 4 years, or five in 6 years, if you want to pull back the camera just a bit more. This edition had Bill Dickey, Lou Gehrig, Tony Lazzari, Red Rolf, Joe DiMaggio, Batman, Wolverine, Superman, Red Ruffing. It was very good. In this game, though, they struggled against the best pitcher on the Red Sox staff that year who was not named Lefty Grove. His name was Jack Wilson. There isn't a ton that I need to tell you about Wilson. He was a very typical pitcher, almost a vanilla pitcher in terms of his career arc and story. He came up, pitched decently at times for a few years without ever being, like, great. And then he wasn't. And it was over. There were no All-Star games, no World Series shutouts, no no-hitters. It was just a standard baseball career. 1937 was his peak season. He went 16-10 with a 3.70 ERA, which you park in league adjust and it's quite good. And he ranked second in the American League in strikeout rate with 5.6 per nine. Nowadays, batters strike out 5.6 times per nine innings, but back then, that was a dominating rate. So he started against the Yankees, and for a while, dominant is an overused word, but heck, let's call it dominant in a 1930s context. Over the first seven innings, Wilson allowed just one hit, a Joe DiMaggio triple, and he stranded DiMaggio. He walked five. He struck out nine. He started showing signs of fatigue in the bottom of the eighth, loading the bases with two outs on a single and a couple of walks, brought DiMaggio up again, but this time he got DiMaggio to fly out, so no runs scored. Meanwhile, the Red Sox had scored six against the Yankee starter Monty Pearson, so they went to the bottom of the ninth up 6-1. Even today, it is very hard to blow that lead, or especially today, it is very hard to blow that lead because of, well, closers who throw at light speed for three batters, but even then, you're not going to blow a ton of 6-1 leads. As you know, in baseball, it's just very hard to plate five runs to tie a game like that before you make three outs. Here's how the ninth inning went for the Yankees and Red Sox. Wilson still pitching. Pay attention to where Joe Cronin makes his call to the bullpen. Lou Gehrig leads off and draws a walk, trots down to first base to bring up outfielder Jake Powell, another legendary racist ball player who did some things that are even darker than that in some ways. Again, a story for another day. He flew out to left field, one down, runner on first. Merrill Hoag, another outfielder, comes up. He too walks. Runners on first and second, one out. This was the second game of a doubleheader, so a lot of Yankees regulars had this one off. Thus, backup catcher Joe Glenn, who started, comes to the plate. He flew out to right field, so runners on first and second, two down. All the Red Sox need is one out to get away with a win. Don Hefner, utility infielder playing second base, he comes to bat. He hits a triple. Gehrig crosses the plate. Hoag crosses the plate. The score is 6-3. It's the pitcher's turn at bat. Joe McCarthy, Yankees manager, goes to his bench, calls on Bill Dickey, so would you. Dickey comes to the plate. Jack Wilson's still sitting there. Dickey pulls a double to chase Hefner home, 6-4. Dickey having pinch hit for the pitcher, we wrap around to the top of the order, and shortstop Frankie Crisetti. Crisetti taps a grounder to Cronin himself at shortstop. Game over, right? Not so much. Cronin heaves it away. Jack Salzgaver, who had pinch run for Dickey, scores. That makes the score 6-5. Wilson is still there. What the heck? The error wasn't his fault, it was Cronin's fault. But when he walked the next batter, Red Rolfe, that was his fault. Runners on first and second, two outs. Joe DiMaggio at the plate again. So far in the game, DiMaggio has tripled, struck out, popped foul, and flown out to center field. He was only in his second major league season then, but everyone already knew what a ridiculously dangerous hitter he was. You're Joe Cronin. You make the call. Joe Cronin does nothing. DiMaggio knocks a single. Crisetti scores 6-6. There are runners on first and second. Cronin finally shrugs his shoulders and walks from the shortstop position to the mound and calls to the bullpen. A pitcher named Tommy Thomas replaces Wilson. And to shorten things up quite a bit at this point, we're now back to Lou Gehrig. Gehrig hits a ball to the moon. John Sterling makes a really obnoxious call of the whole thing, and the Yankees walk off 9-6. In last week's show, I talked about Steve Barber's losing no-hitter and how Hank Bauer, when he finally went out to the mound to relieve Barber, said sadly, "I tried to get it for you." This was another one of those situations of trying to get it for the pitcher, it being the win. No, it wasn't a no-hitter, and I don't have a quote from Cronin to show you to say that that's what he was thinking about, but I think it's very safe to infer it from the play-by-play that I just described to you. It was only when the tying run crossed the plate that he removed a clearly gassed pitcher. And even if the pitcher wasn't gassed, he had ceased to fool anyone. Cronin lost the game for the Red Sox because getting Wilson a hash mark in the W column was more important than getting the Red Sox, the overall team, a hash mark in the W column.
Nope, nope. Oh, hey. Oh. I told me to be chicken, and you got me. Oh, I.
it's just not the same in this context, is it? And yes, the toy bears are singing It's All Peachy Keen, Strange Planet that. But go ahead, do the little dance. It is all peachy keen because Cronin comported himself according to something that he believed in. And I'll tell you, everybody else believed in it too. None of the coverage of this game questions his moves, but frames the ending simply in terms of the Yankees' wonderfulness and their great ability to hit, not in terms of Cronin's inactivity or Wilson's falling apart. If you could grab Cronin with your time machine and ask him, what were you thinking that day? Well, after you interrogated him over all the racist stuff he helped perpetuate with the Red Sox, you'd ask him, why was getting Wilson the win so important for you? Why was it more important than winning the game for the team? I imagine he might answer you in so many words, that was what was important to us. These are the things that we valued. And that answer is sufficient unto itself. You can't interrogate it. You can't ask for any further definition or reasoning to support it because there was no reason involved with it to begin with. It's just something that they decided that that's where the emphasis should be. It's like questioning someone's religious faith. They believe it because they believe it, and the very act of trying to justify it is counter to the rules. Well, religion remains religion, and we won't go there, but we no longer think of pitcher wins the same way that Joe Cronin and his contemporaries did. They are not sufficient unto themselves. They are not the goal itself. They are just something that happens that we hold on to as part of the overall accounting of things. Whether it's Max Scherzer or Jason Vargas who started the game, at the end, you are going to see Wade Davis or Craig Kimbrell or Kenley Jansen. The starting pitcher's pride, the starting pitcher's feelings, we don't give a damn. It's a team game, and the team wins or everyone loses. And here's the bottom line. My goal in telling you this story is not to make fun of Joe Cronin for something that happened 81 years ago and to point out his primitive beliefs or his contemporaries' primitive beliefs in terms of how to run a ball game. It's to ask this question. What values do we have today that will seem idiotic to people less than a century in the future? Have no doubt, there are many of them. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Forest under a nave of leaves lies the Church of the Foxes, and there the foxes plot their rebellion. They have gathered to them all the lost children. There are so many, not for eating, but to care for them and to teach them the way of the fox, which, yes, is to steal, but to steal only what you need for survival and no more. These lost children, the ones who have aged out of infancy and therefore are no longer cared about by those who instinctively cling to babies but not to the harder work of raising children, are fed on the rarest bits of rabbit. And when the time comes, they will march forth clad in leaves and weeds, foxes riding on their shoulder, all of them together, chanting the song of our shame. The only question is the date. No one knows. The foxes are very cautious and may never move. Many generations have passed since they conceived this idea and began gathering the children to them. Doesn't matter, in a sense, because the children are safer there, safer even than they would be in episode 56. The only problem is a contract has been signed with the Global Industrial Timber Company and the forest
deep within which the Church of Foxes lies, will soon be cut down to make paper towels and new editions of popular books of sadomasochistic erotica. What will happen to the foxes then, and to the children they have saved? No one knows, and no one cares. Welcome back to the show. Today, I am rejoined by David Roth in his usual spot in the non-rotation rotation, and we discussed a great many and sundry things, including the graying of the Mets, the joy of watching Shohei Ohtani succeed, and David's wonderful video podcast. Is that what you call it? I don't know. A show, I guess, is what you call it. Let's Remember Some Guys, in which he just rips random packs of cards and vamps on who he sees, which doesn't sound like anything, but I don't know. I find it terrifically amusing, and it's neat to compare my free association on different players with what is triggered in his great brain. So stay tuned for that. Before we roll David in here, a few words on what I am calling the Jim Devlinification of everything. That is not an easy word to say, Devlinification, but I think you'll agree that it's appropriate. I'm going to tell you in advance what the theme of my Devlinification story is, and it's simply this, that the integrity of a system matters more than winning if the system is debauched. Eventually, winning will be impossible. Jim Devlin played in the very early National League at the beginning of the 1870s. He was born in Philadelphia in 1849, so we're going way back in time here. He had a receding hairline, big mustache. He was a pitcher and a first baseman, and as far as I can tell, because who really knows about 19th century baseball, he was pretty good at both jobs. That's the thing about primitive sports leagues. The guys who are at the top of the athletic scale are so far ahead of the average player that they can do anything. It's the same reason that even today, your top high school prospects have crazy good stats, things that would be just impossible in the major leagues, and it's that the full filtering has not happened yet, the weeding out. So they play against kids who are, in some cases, also very good, and others who are just there to fill out the roster and are going to graduate and then major in accounting and will never pick up a bat and glove again. So, sure, they hit 500, and they pitched no-hitters with more strikeouts than are possible in a 27-out game. When you add in just how many standard deviations above the average then Devlin was to the fact that pitchers pitched pretty much every day back then, you have the possibility of these crazy war totals. Here I quote Baseball Reference. In 1876, Devlin pitched for the Louisville Grays in the National League. He went 30-35 in 68 starts, threw 622 innings, walked 37, think about that, and led the league with 122 strikeouts. His record was just one decision off from Louisville's record. The team itself was 30-36. His ERA was 1.56, total wins above replacement, 17.7. He also hit .315 in 299 plate appearances, so tack on another 1.7 war. Again, he wasn't necessarily Shohei Ohtani. This is just the way things went at that time. He was so great that his career ended almost immediately the next year in 1877. Here's why. The 1877 Louisville team was very good to a point. They played a 60-game schedule. On August 13, they were 27-13 with just 20 games left to play, and they were leading the league by 4 games. They had won 14 of their last 17, so they were on a roll. Over the next couple of weeks, however, they went 1-15-1. Perhaps not coincidentally, 4 players on the team started dressing very well during that stretch, sporting diamond-headed canes and the like. At that point, once that stretch was over, they started winning again. They went 7-2 the rest of the way, but it was too late. Boston won the pennant by 7 games, just sailed past them, because anyone can sail past you when you're going 1-15-1. And it wasn't just bad luck. It wasn't just a slump. At that time, Charles Chase, who was the Louisville team president, was getting anonymous telegrams saying things along the lines of, "Gamblers are betting against your team, stupid!" He did nothing. On a statistical basis, Devlin, for the season, was, again, one of the best pitchers in the league, but He happened to pitch badly during this stretch, and yes, in fact, gamblers had gotten to him. There were additional clues, like the fact that the odds in the big betting pools kept going the wrong way. And there were places where big betting pools were operated, and they set odds for these various ball games. And suppose that today, the Astros were going to play the Reds. The Astros would be heavy favorites, right? But before Gray's games against the Reds of their day, who in fact were the same Reds, it was the Cincinnati Reds. This is the early National League. So it's sort of the same club, and they were just as lame. And someone, a lot of someones, knew that the games weren't on the up and up. So suddenly, the smart money was being placed against the Grays and on the Reds. And the telegrams that Chase was getting were coming from places where some of these big betting pools were located. That's another clue. Well, after the season, the team started looking into things, and so did journalists, and the conclusion was that four players, George Hall, Al Nichols, Bill Craver, and Devlin, had sold out. The team hadn't been paying them regularly, so they did have some incentive to cheat. There was conclusive evidence in the form of telegrams with coded words that were easily decipherable, and that winter, the National League permanently barred those players. Devlin was 28 years old. I regret that those four players did not get more in the way of due process. There was, as far as I can tell, no hearing. There was no formal investigation, questioning of witnesses, pleas, or anything of the like. It was just decided, door closed. If we can take their guilt at face value, then this was absolutely, absolutely the right thing to do. And I want to emphasize why. Forget moral rights and wrongs. Forget the so-called evils of gambling. Forget that it's not clear as to whether they threw league games or some of the exhibitions that then also crowded the schedule and would continue to do so well into the 20th century. Those things matter, but the bigger issue here is simply that of trust, of having a functioning system. As it was in the aftermath of the scandal, the Grays went out of business, they were kicked out of the league, so were the St. Louis Brown Stockings, which sounds like an American League team, but that's a separate group. That came later. This all gets very confusing with names jumping around as much as teams did. But they had signed Devlin, and I guess that just that act implicated them. William Hulbert, who was running the National League at that time, was very strict in terms of who could be on the circuit and who couldn't. And in fact, the year before had punted a couple of teams, including the one in New York, for not completing its schedule, which was a thing that happened then also. We don't feel like it. We don't have the money. Never mind. But Hulbert understood that in order for the league to be treated as a real, meaningful thing, you had to actually show up for the games. That was kind of a minimum prerequisite. William Hulbert, I'm going to call him Bill. I don't know if anyone called him Bill, but Bill Hulbert was really the guy who got the National League on its feet and made sure that it survived those unstable early years. And he understood that the players needed to be perceived as honest. I mean, this was his approach to everything. What he came into was this inchoate system. And he said, what if we run things professionally, slightly organized, legitimately competitive? And then he died. But for the time that he was involved in baseball, he did a great deal to get the game to take itself seriously, and thereby for everyone else to take it seriously. No Hulbert, maybe somebody else would have come along, but it might have been a long time before baseball really got organized in a way that comes down to us today. He was the one behind these expulsions. Despite the fact that he knew and liked Devlin, he felt that it was for the greater good that these four players go. Devlin did not do well having been chucked out of baseball. He did not have a fallback of any kind. He wasn't really trained to do anything else. Al Spalding, who was another important figure in the early days of the game, wrote about seeing Devlin appear in Hulbert's offices in rags and drop to his knees, literally begging for mercy to be reinstated. Do it not for me, but do it for my wife and child, he said. They were starving. According to Spalding, Hulbert, weeping, pulled $50 out of his wallet and handed it to Devlin. That's what I think of you personally, Devlin. But damn you, you were dishonest and you sold out a game. I can't trust you. Now go on your way and never let me see your face again, for your act against the integrity of baseball will never be condoned as long as I live. Now, that's very dramatic, and those words seem a little too on point, as if they were written for a scene in a movie. I think that very few of us, if an ex-friend dropped by and threw his arms around our ankles in tears, begging for food and money, would make speeches about integrity exactly that way, even if, as Hulbert clearly had, we decided that it was necessary to cut all ties and throw them out. $50 didn't go that far even then, and Devlin kept trying. This is a letter he wrote to the future Hall of Famer Harry Wright, who managed the Boston Red Stockings. That team, too, is still with us. It's not the Red Sox, it's the Braves. Devlin's spelling was original. He spelled could as co-ed. I don't think he had a lot of formal education or any, but I'm going to read this to you as he meant it. Philadelphia, February 24th, 1878. Mr. Harry Wright, dear sir, as I am deprived from playing this year, I thought I would write you to see if you could do anything for me in the way of looking after your ground or anything in the way of work. I don't know what I am to do. I've tried hard to get work of any kind, but I can't get it. Do you know of any way that you think I could get to play again? I can assure you, Harry, that I was not treated right, and if ever I can see you to tell you the case, you will say I am not to blame. I am living from hand to mouth all winter. I haven't got a stitch of clothing, or has my wife and child. You don't know how I am situated, for I know if you did, you would do something for me. I am honest, Harry. You need not be afraid. The Louisville people made me what I am today, a beggar. I trust you will not say anything to anyone about the contents of this. If you can do me this favor by letting me take care of the ground or anything of that kind, I beg of you to do it, and God will reward you if I don't, or let me know if you have any idea of how I could get back. I am dumb, Harry. I don't know how to go about it, so I trust you will answer this and do all you can for me. So I will close by sending you and George and all the boys my very best wishes, hoping to hear from you soon. I am yours, truly, James A. Devlin, number 908 Atherton Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Nothing came of that letter, and sadly, that was right, because what Hulbert and Wright, too, were doing was establishing norms of behavior where none had existed. Hulbert had entered an ethical and legal vacuum and began to create a structure by which this organism, baseball, would comport itself. And the idea that these games were real were not being faked. There was a term at the time, hippodroming, which meant that the players, having been bribed so that the game had a preordained outcome, then acted through, pantomimed, the appearance of playing an actual competitive baseball game, but it was all a fraud. Well, Hulbert was trying to eliminate that, because how long would baseball last if you knew it was just pro wrestling? This is really how everything works if you think about it, how every structure that people devise works. Things start as disorganized, they get organized, and then the forces of entropy tear at them continually and try to pull them back to a disorganized state. Because disorganization is random and can be very damaging, but it can also be twisted to one's own advantage. Imagine, if you would, a world in which no one enforced the rules, and those charged with making sure that our institutions, such as baseball, did nothing to protect those rules at all. Say, for example, the Chicago White Sox, the current Chicago White Sox, not the 1919 Chicago White Sox, tired of this season's 300 winning percentage and just wanted to remember what it felt like to win a few games. And knowing that they weren't going to do that legitimately, the way that everyone else does, hitting home runs, striking people out, they decide to buy a few victories. So they, whenever they face a kid pitcher, say, who hasn't gotten into the real money yet, and maybe he's pretty fringy, he's on the bubble, he's going to be sent down, and there's a good chance he's not going to be back. That's how bad he is. They know it. He knows it. They offer him a little incentive so that when he does go back down, when he is inevitably released, he will have a little nest egg in the bank to cushion his descent. And what do you know? He's a little wild that day, and the White Sox win. Now, if you're a White Sox fan, you enjoy that win and any wins that they achieve in the same way, and you're happy not knowing how that sausage got made. If there was more to it than luck, well, we'll let you keep dreaming. What's the harm in that? And you know what? In an isolated instance, probably there isn't a lot of harm. If you believe that you'll get your just reward or punishment in the hereafter, maybe there's some harm. But in terms of the overall game, whatever, water under the bridge. And you, our hypothetical White Sox fan, can go along feeling safe and secure about the integrity of the system because, yeah, maybe some of those White Sox games weren't on the up and up, but everything else is, pretty much. Later, though, as others see how the system has been degraded, how the White Sox worked it, that same weapon, that same vulnerability that they exposed can be turned against the White Sox. And maybe their players can be bought off to lose games they might otherwise have won. And at that point, when everyone's doing it, you can't trust anything. You can't selectively believe in integrity. You're either all for a rational system, or you're signing up for a world in which anything can happen. Some days you may wield the knife, but on other days, the knife belongs to somebody else, and it's better for all concerned if the knife is under glass in a museum somewhere. Yes, this is a metaphor for other things happening in our world. I'm not going to disguise that. The White Sox are not throwing games for real, not in 2018 anyway, but other people in other arenas are trying to throw games or suborn others into throwing them or convince you that throwing them or bribing others to throw them isn't such a big deal, that there are worse things happening. And if worse things are happening while ball games are being thrown, well, overlook the ball games being thrown and concentrate on this other thing over here. It's more important. Seriously. Look at the birdie. See, they think that those rules aren't for their protection, and they aren't today. But when the other guy holds the talking stick, grasps that knife that floats freely once you untether it from the rules, those same rules might be the only thing that saves them from the gibbet. Saves all of us. The whole point of civilization is that the wild, wild west, when men shoot first and ask questions later, is kind of fun to watch on a movie screen, not so cool to live through. It is far better to have life be kind of predictable and not have to worry that if you go out to the grocery store for milk, that you do not get shot just because someone felt like shooting you, or the people in authority don't have you arrested because you bought the brand of milk that is out of favor with those in power. And you know the rules that promote fair trials are a pain in the butt, but if you're ever in the dock, you're going to want those rules because you're going to want a fair trial. Ask any victim of Stalin how much show there is in show trials. Not a lot. No clowns. Jim Devlin suffered badly for a few years, so unfortunately did his family. Eventually, this crooked player finally got a job of all things walking the beat as a Philadelphia police officer. Almost immediately, however, he contracted tuberculosis and died. He was of late years a patrolman in the 2nd District, his Philadelphia Inquirer obituary reads, and when his last illness incapacitated him for work, a match game was given for his benefit. Financially, you see, it hadn't gotten any better. He still needed help. And there's no shame in that, in needing help, of course, except for the reason why he had gotten into such dire straits in the first place. He had broken faith with his own best interests, prizing short-term gains over long-term security. And that's the position that we all find ourselves in, asking whether a short-term gain in any system by one team or the other is worth unraveling the rules by which all teams are constrained and therefore may not win. But when they do win, they win legitimately. As always, mull that over. We will take a break for a word from our sponsors, and then I will return with the one, the only, David Roth. Hang in there, won't you?
Thank you.
Someday I'm going to do my covers album and record my adaptation of Nick Lowe's What's So Funny About Peace, Roth, and Understanding. Roth and Understanding is what we're here for today. And so I am pleased to be joined by Deadspin's own David Roth. How are you, David?
I'm good, Stephen. How are you doing? I always appreciate these read-ons because they are never quite what I expect them to be.
You know, they're from the heart. I can't do anything normally, as you know. I can't just, you know, be the star of stage, screen, and radio. You know, I have to say what I feel. And today,
it's a Stephen Goldman thing. Here, yeah. I stand making Nick Lowe puns. I can do no other.
Right, because Nick Lowe might be listening, and for everybody else, it's probably completely lost. But actually, I feel a little more sort of dislocated than usual. While I was waiting for you to drop by, I decided to spin up the latest episode of one of the, it turns out, several, you have an empire going podcasts that you participate in, the latest of the Deadspin shows. And I know you have no control over the ad content, just as I have no control over the ad content.
I think I know where you're going with this. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Like, I mean, I get like Panera and McDonald's and I feel really good about that, but except for the fact that I think it probably leads people to expect that I'm financially doing vastly better than I am because I'm getting some of those sweet, sweet Egg McMuffin bucks.
Yeah.
But no, not a whole lot of that trickles down. So I click play. And I hear a woman in a sultry voice, "Do you want to spice up your time in the bedroom?" And I was, I had to make sure I had not clicked the wrong podcast or possibly the right podcast,
yeah,
honestly, just not the one that I expected. So it turned out to be Adam and Eve. And as great as Drew and you and Lauren were talking about hockey after that, I have to admit it was a little, pardon the expression, anticlimactic.
No, I think it's fair to say that we peaked fairly early with that one. As you know, of course, Adam and Eve, both great friends, personal friends of mine, and longtime listeners of the cast. They wanted to be included. We were happy. We thought it was simpatico. I'm excited by the fact that there's an ad on there just because it's funny to me. And then the fact that it led off was really delightful, like a real eye opener. Because I listened to, you know, I had to do like a little blog post putting the thing up. And I listened, you know, through to the podcast again. We just recorded it yesterday, but I like to be reminded of what I said when I was blacked out and in take mode. And I didn't expect it to be there, but, you know, thought it was a fairly tasteful ad and certainly one of the three or four most erotic things that's ever happened on that podcast during my time there. It was different when Tim Marchman was on it.
I could do this whole show in that voice, except that, as you know, I sometimes or often do these little sort of microfictions before the show. And a good friend of mine has told me that he finds it deeply upsetting in an emotional way when I do women's voices. So
yeah, it's fair to say, but
I'm pushed off center when I talk at all. But so okay, we'll forego that. But as long as we're on the subject of Deadspin podcast, is actually a video podcast, I guess is the right way to do it. One of the things that I did this morning in preparation for this discussion was I binge watched pretty much all of Let's Remember Some Guys. And I think as much as I love your writing, this is, as a baseball fan, this is one of my favorite things that you're doing. And what it is you and Lauren Tyson sit down on a set and she holds up a baseball card and you react to it. And lately there's a torturous twist in that if you don't have a strong memory of that guy, you have to shove chunks of gum into your mouth.
Yeah, like a double bubble too, which is, as the name implies, twice the bubble that you get from a regulation bubble gum. I had in one video three pieces of double bubble in my mouth and I was trying to talk about Mickey Tettleton while basically having like some other loose gum tongue in my mouth moving around. And it was terrible, but also it's a lot easier than writing. So I did like it. I'm glad that you've enjoyed it. We have, there's going to be another one that's going to come out on Friday where Jeff Katz, who is the mayor of Cooperstown for a long time and is also a baseball historian and a baseball card guy, came down and we ripped some packs of 1981 Fleer, which is one of the dumbest sets. Like they that was the year that Topps's their exclusive was struck down. And so Donruss and Fleer both rushed to put out baseball card sets. And you could really feel the rushing because the photos are super shitty and blurry, or just, it seems like really like there was one photo of Rod Scurry taken that year. And it happened to be a profile photo that like was really mostly a picture of somebody else. And like, that's his baseball card. There's one of Rick Waits where it looks like he looks like a guy that would be sort of not a speaking part, but just like a guy in the holding tank in an episode of Hill Street Blues, like just real nervous and twitchy seeming, and his hair's not right. And that's his baseball card from 1981.
Doesn't Waits always seem like, and I remember Rick Waits, but whenever I hear, just for some reason, whenever I hear the name Rick Waits, like if you told me like, yeah, he was in a prog rock band with Emerson, oh, yeah, Lake, and
it's a very like a dude wearing a cape sort of name. I've always enjoyed prog rock names as like a baseball, sort of like a branch of it. And there was one, it was the trade that sent Didi Gregorius from the, I guess, to the Diamondbacks from the Reds. Is that right?
Yes.
Or to the, or the other way around. I don't know. Whatever it was like everyone that was involved in that trade had a kind of a prog rock name. Like Didi Gregorius is an extremely prog rock name to me. Lars Anderson was also involved in that trade, which is another like more low key, like kind of like a guy that was in Yes briefly, but there was like personality conflicts and like was asked to leave. But yeah, in this rich world of bizarre baseball names, I think that that's a niche that is meaningful and that I hope grows.
Drew Stubbs was also in that trade, but I think he was in the Allman Brothers.
Yeah, Drew Stubbs definitely has more of a like kind of like roadie or like whatever problematic boyfriend of Marianne Faithful or something like that. Like there's like
when Lars Anderson, you know, got fired from Yes, there must have been some argument over Tales of Topographic Oceans where, as the purist, he said, we have to do songs that take up whole sides, but we have to have more than one song per side. And they just had a really hard time explaining to him that you can't do that. It's one or the other.
So I like the idea of like Rick Wakeman just being like, you don't even know the difference between a goblin and a and like whatever. I don't have time to teach you, Lars. I don't, because we're touring, because we're Yes.
This one's about Tom Bombadil, and that one. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, what an amazing era for rock and roll that was. Just like the nerdiest guys ever to have mass volumes of sex, like Robert Plant. Like, just people that, like, by rights should have just been wearing, like, black sweatpants all the time. And yet somehow they were instead selling out Wembley Stadium and dating movie stars.
And some of it is really good. Some of it, I mean, I'm a fan of the Peter Gabriel era Genesis stuff. But yeah, some of it, you say that as if you're skeptical. But maybe off the air sometime, I'll try to proselytize on that.
No, I have some of those records. They're extremely easy to get for a dollar. I think some of them are good. It's definitely, like, it's just weird because, like, I think the hard part with it is just trying to convince people that Genesis was ever anything but, like, you know, waiting room music.
Right.
That it was, like, once kind of, like, weird and the songs had too many, like, ambitious, like, sort of, like, signatures and, like, key changes.
Sometimes, yes, but definitely. So I realized watching endless episodes of Let's Remember Some Guys, I was like, boy, I want to talk to David. I want to guest star on this show. And then I realized
I want you to guest star on it.
I think I'd be bad for it in a sense, or I have to kind of, because now, to freely admit it, as much as I know about old timey baseball players, there were times you were stumped that I would have been stumped too. Like, I would not really know what to say off the top of my head about Rob Woodward, 1980s Red Sox pitcher, or Jeff Calhoun, yeah, Astros middle reliever. And more so than Woodward, Jeff Calhoun actually had a decent season or two, but there's not a lot of detail. He didn't have a lot of wins or a lot of losses or a lot of saves. He was just there. And so yeah, I would be stumped by those guys. The thing that I would have to resist is like when you got dealt an Ed Whitson card. There are paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs that I can speak on Ed Whitson, and these episodes only run 5 minutes. So I would defeat the purpose.
That's not – see, well, if I may make the case for you appearing on one of these, if that's something that you would like to do, that's – I mean, it's what Jeff did, what Jeff Katz did with the 81 set, and I think it's actually – it's better that way. I mean, it might be harder on the editors or whatever, but when you actually do have a story about a lot of these – I mean, I just think that's more interesting. With Whitson, I mostly remembered that he was tormented by Steinbrenner, and I wasn't sure if it was him or Gene Nelson that was accused of having spit the bit. I went back and looked it up, and it was indeed Gene Nelson that was accused of having spit the bit. Yes. But the in all those cases, it's, you know, like, so they edited some of that out. Like, I did remember it. But I think, you know, the having these vast reserves of useless information in your head, like, I want to help you leverage that on as many platforms as possible. Because we at this point, I think in both of our lives, it's just clear that we're not going to ever replace it with anything better. So you need to find some way to perform it for maximum delightment of people. A lot of these guys I remember as baseball cards more than as players too. I mean, I have to say that, like, Calhoun, I remember watching pitch against the Mets, but, like, you know, there wasn't, like, national games. Like, the teams that I probably saw the Cubs and the Braves second and third most out of any of the team, or I guess fourth, you know, behind the Yankees and Mets, just because of where I grew up. But that was, like, there was nothing that could be done about that.
No, it's true, and I'm sure I've sang this song before on this show, and not to be overly, like, and the kids won't believe it when you tell them, but as you know, and I'm a little older than you, but not so much that this is exclusive to me, between the two of us, there was a time when not everything was just instantaneously on demand, and so Saturday afternoons, if you wanted to see a game that was not the local team's, then it was Vin Scully and Joe Garagiola doing whatever, the Cubs Astros from Wrigley Field. Whether you wanted Cubs Astros or not, that's what you were getting.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes there was a B game with Bob Costas and Tony Kubek, but right, if they didn't focus on the Padres, and most of the time, why would they? Right. Then you could have gone Tony Gwynn's entire career without seeing Tony Gwynn play.
Which is, I mean, in some ways is obviously, like, kind of a drag. And then also, like, the immediacy and, you know, like, super availability of everything. At this point, it's clear to say has, you know, turned people into terrible babies. Like, that, whatever, that old Louis C.K. bit about people complaining about having a wireless in an airplane, but it's imperfect. And it's like, well, you're, right. You're in a tube in the sky. Like, in this case, like, yeah, the idea of complaining about, like, MLB extra innings because, like, it's not it's giving you Shohei Ohtani on a 30-second delay or some shit is, like, I don't know. Like, I'm old enough to remember when that seemed like a miracle.
No, I do too, and I don't know whether to mourn the loss of that or not. And the other example is before all music being available all the time, or all movies, or all books. Like, I used to travel all over the country to old record stores and used bookstores and comic book stores. And, you know, today, if you have a, I don't know, complete run of Amazing Spider-Man or something, and you want number 74, you can find it online somewhere, and you might pay for it, but you can find it. Whereas it was just this luck that you might drift into a comic book store in Helena, Montana, which I actually did. It wasn't the only reason I was there, but nevertheless, like, and if they happened to have it, then you were in luck, but otherwise you might not see it again for 10 years.
I think, I mean, I hope people still treasure that experience. I think there's, like, a certain type of person that really has that, like, record collector brain or whatever you want to call it, that, like, really would rather do that than be on, like, Discogs looking for stuff.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I have to admit that nowadays I go for the instant gratification.
Yeah.
And,
well, there's not, know, that many just used record stores around anymore.
I mean, well, right. It's all circular. So, speaking about things that might change, to get to the actual sportsiness of this, since this is topical, I hadn't initially planned to talk about this, and it's a little maybe wonkish for you and I, but let's give it a shot. Not long before we connected up here, Major League Baseball came out with a report that said, yeah, all the home run hitting over the past few years, or however many years it goes back, is probably attributable to some extent to the construction of the baseballs. It's not guys uppercutting. It's not global warming has increased the heat of the season to such a degree that balls are just being wafted out, but that it's a decrease in the drag on the baseballs. They are just knifing through the air like sharks, to mix metaphors. Sharks don't do that except on certain sci-fi network programs, but that's what's happening. They don't really say why or what they're going to do about it. Maybe the seams have been lowered. I don't know that they're adjusting the seams or anything. But
what's funny is that MLB doesn't seem to know either. Like, the idea that this completely snuck up on them is the part that's blown my mind about it.
Well, yeah, it's very strange because, say, and I know that this was a tempest in a teapot and more annoying than anything else. But on one hand, we have the NFL, and yes, we will get to the NFL later. But they supposedly care so much about the consistency of the footballs that you had this whole Deflategate thing that dragged on for what seemed like two centuries with the New England Patriots. And then on the other hand, you have baseball, which is like, oh, we got
that another case of baseball? Did we pick them up at a flea market or something? Was it some kind of consignment sale? Yeah, put those out there. We'll see what Clayton Kershaw can do with them.
It is weird, too, because it's the sort of thing, I think just the presumption of innocence in this case, just taking MLB at its word that it's like actually as lazy and checked out in this process as they seem to be pretending to be. Like, I find that way more upsetting than the idea of them just like monkeying around with it because everybody loves dingers. Like, it really seems weird to me that, I mean, I don't know if it's a new contract or whatever it is, but like, I was shocked at them pretending to be so in the dark about this and then being like, you know, so we did some tests and like, what, like, when were you going to do that? Like, how did you not do that first? I imagine that this is probably in some ways, you know, attributable to this pursuit of, I'm sure that they took the lowest bidder and, you know, that they'll continue to take the lowest bidder every time some new, you know, facility is bidding on it. And so like, who knows where the corners are getting cut or whatever, but this is, you know, maybe an argument for finding a place that can do it exactly the way that you want to do it every time and sticking with them.
You would think, though, that that would be, like you said, something they would care about. And in the same way that over the years they've hired, you know, dignified Hall of Fame types like Frank Robinson or Joe Torre to have front office roles, that you would reach out to, I don't know, just Tom Seaver or somebody and say, you are now minister of ball quality and just keep an eye on this. And, you know, sign some of them for the kids occasionally. And then you would know exactly what was happening at all times.
It is weird that they would not, especially because that does seem to be like, it's significantly easier than like whatever they hired Sandy Alderson to be like whatever the cop on the beat in the Dominican Republic and on like the Buscone issue and like whatever players with fake IDs and getting exploited and everything like that. Like, that's a hard job that they actually like hired a competent person for. This is just somebody that needs to like go to a facility in Haiti every 6 months and like take a bunch of phone meetings. Like, it's
right.
I'm not saying that I would do a good job of it, but I, you know, I'm available and I don't think I could do worse than, you know, whatever the previous non-existent service.
Right. They're not doing anything. So my question is, assuming that they do actually do something to attack this, and given the various laws of unintended consequences that always seem to happen when they mess with the baseball one way or the other, and maybe you get some kind of reaction that's more extreme than what they intended, if they do adjust it and maybe home runs decrease a little bit or a lot, we will see a new era of baseball take place. And there's nothing wrong with that per se, because as you know, baseball has changed in its shape over and over and over again, going back to the 1870s. But do you think that fans have been so conditioned now to just this profligate number of home runs going back, I guess, to like 1995 or so now, that they will be able to adjust, like say we go, you know, this is where I'm going to go, but like, say we go back to the 1980s where like you don't have 20 guys hitting 40 to 50 home runs every year, but it's just like one Jesse Barfield or one Kevin Mitchell every year. And maybe a few more guys who have 35 or 30. And then it's a more diverse offense. Are people ready for that, or will they be bored by it?
I think it depends. I don't think that they'd be bored. I mean, I feel like home runs in some ways, like, I mean, this is not one of the ways that MLB is attacking this problem, but like, they kind of slow the game down a little bit. Like, it's this, and I think that in some ways, like, all these home runs and all these strikeouts, like, I happen to like both of those things because I have a very, like, I'm into baseball. Like, I like watching it, whatever it looks like, you know. I sometimes I like it more than others. It really depends on which Mets reliever is pitching at that time. But there is a definite sense to me that MLB needs to maybe be a little bit more confident, needs to trust its stuff a little bit and just like stop trying to put fires out and constantly talk about how the games are too long and too boring and nobody wants to watch them anymore. Like, the league is healthy. Everybody's making money. Like, the on balance, like, the parity could be a little bit better and the tanking teams are troubling, but there are some really good teams and really good players right now. Like, I feel like if they want to level this out so that it's a little bit less hyped up, I don't think that anyone would be too upset. I mean, I think if, you know, if you wind up with some dead ball era shit, then yeah, I think people would probably be a little bit frustrated by it. But I don't know. I don't understand why they constantly treat things that are not crises like crises, and why they also would be so gun shy when it comes to stuff like this. Like, I think if Aaron Judge hits 10 fewer homers in a year, he's not going to sell any fewer t-shirts. They're still going to be cool when they happen, you know?
Right, right. And but I think the opposite end, you can be overly sated with that. And I don't know if I'm remembering the right game. There was a 12-11 game in the World Series last fall between the Astros and the Dodgers. I think that was the particularly the one game in the playoffs that stood out this way, where it was like inning one, home run, home run, home run. And then inning two, home run, single walk, home run. And it just went like that over and over and over again. And when everyone in the lineup can hit one out, maybe that's a testament to scouting or bodybuilding or a whole lot of things, but it also takes away the specialness of the act itself.
It does, I think. And I think I don't know if you do fantasy baseball, but I've had this experience in recent years at the drafts, especially this year, you know, sort of going through and reacquainting yourself with the player pool. And there were guys that hit 30 home runs last year that were not drafted in a 10 or a 12 team league. You know, they're just like, there was enough guys that hit 30 homers that played the outfield that were better than them that, like, Scott Schebler is there for you if you need to sign it. You know, if that's like a move you need to make. But yeah, I mean, to me, like, I think the argument for it, like, on an aesthetic basis is the one that I find most compelling. And it's not the argument that, you know, Major League Baseball is going to make, obviously. But yeah, I mean, I think that's right. The idea of, you know, it's cool that there are, you know, talented players. It's cool that there are more of them and more different kinds. I don't think anybody's going to have a problem with that. But the idea of it all kind of flattening out into endless processions of like three true outcome guys that like hit a lot of homers and strike out 165 times. Like, I don't know that. I think it could be boring in the same way that like the NBA, if it takes its fascination with a certain type of athletic build and a certain type of skills and projects it so that the league is entirely 6'8" guys with 7'3" wingspans that shoot threes. Like, that could very well be boring, but at the same time, there's some new bit of counterpunching or sort of contra innovation that problematizes that and keeps it from happening.
This is the one area where it's hard to do that in baseball because want to cut down on batting average, I mean, you can have the shift. If you want to cut down on late inning comebacks, you can have a bunch of guys in the bullpen who throw 100 miles an hour. But if the ball just is going to travel, you can't, you know, raise gravity. You can't, other than altering the ball, you can't really do anything about
that. Yeah, that's true. And I think that's like maybe where, you know, the intervention makes the most sense. Although who knows that there's not some stuff that we haven't, I mean, I think that you're probably right, but I think that there's also ways in which teams are constantly trying to find some sort of new way around the problems that have always been there. And sometimes they come up with interesting new stuff. I think that the idea of like just having more guys throwing 100 miles an hour out of the bullpen doesn't necessarily seem to me like a solution for the problem of giving up too many homers. But there's, you know, I remember, this is off topic, but like Chris, or not entirely, but Chris Young, when the Mets brought him in as a free agent, the same Chris who recently ended his career, the pitcher, not the outfielder. They had some sense that he had maybe cracked the code on soft contact, that he gave up a ton of fly balls, but very few homers proportionate to how many fly balls he gave up. And I think that the Mets being the Mets, I mean, they mostly signed him because he cost like $3.5 million. But I think they also were like, maybe he's onto something here. Like at that point, you know, like Citi Field had gone from being an extreme pitcher's park to being, you know, more of a sort of a neutral one. But I think that they thought maybe this is a guy that could uniquely be useful here because of that. And I think that obviously it didn't totally work out, although he did eventually win a World Series ring against them. So I guess you'd have to say it worked out fine for him. But the idea of teams kind of like constantly nibbling on that outside of, you know, various newfangled acronyms, like, I don't know, like, I think there's still some promise there because like there always has to be the possibility of some new thing that we haven't thought of yet. Right.
Well, one is just, hey, push the fences way back and have a lot more triples. And that would be a dead ball era kind of thing. But other than that, I think it's just the ebb and flow of time.
If you build a better mousetrap, bake a better bun, mix a better toddy, you'll have everybody coming on the run. If you wash a better window, sweep a better floor, climb a higher steeple, you'll you'll have all the people knocking at your door. That's the way to be successful. So I'm getting wise. Kissing better kisses, saying sweeter nothings, lying bigger lies. And I'm teasing better teases, squeezing better squeezes. Everything happens but gee, why doesn't anything happen to me?
You're listening to If You Build a Better Mousetrap, performed by Peggy Lee with the Benny Goodman Orchestra. The song was written by the great lyricist Johnny Mercer, music by Victor Schertzinger, who also directed the film in which this song first appeared, The Fleet's Inn, a 1942 Paramount picture, which was the debut of Betty Hutton. She sang it too, but she kind of screamed it, so I thought this would be the better version. We'll take a break for a word from our sponsors, and then we'll be right back with more conversation.
Why doesn't anything happen to us?
Since you brought up the Mets and cheap Mets in particularly, I laughed when I saw you say on Twitter a couple of days ago, and this was on the occasion of Jose Bautista,
yes, Joseph Bats,
being signed. Yes, Joseph R. Bats Esquire. You said, let me just read these two tweets back. There is so much competition for this title, but the Mets' long-running organizational dedication to serving as a sort of hospice for veteran players, a quiet, sort of dignified place to get the last 150 at-bats of your career, is up there. I am not good enough at research to pin this down in relative terms, but just since 2000, I can recall so many guys being eased out of the game as Mets. You'll always be Mets to me, Michael Tucker and Brian Daubach and Trot Nixon and Gerald Williams. Now, you know that having put that challenge out there about research, that I was very tempted to do it. And I started to, and then I quit rapidly because what I found, I think I identified the year of peak Mets AARP baseball.
Ooh, and play it on me.
I'm calling this is the year that earns the Yogi Berra Redundant Encore Yogi Berra Award, because in 1965, the Mets activated 40-year-old coach Yogi Berra, who had been retired for a couple of years, gave him 9 at-bats, and then he retired again. So in 2007, this is one of the Willie Randolph, Omar Minaya team. The catcher, Paul LaDuca, was 35. Carlos Delgado was 35. And I think, I don't know if this was his last year, but he got hurt and retired pretty peremptorily. Luis Castillo was 31. Moise Alou was 40. Sean Green, also in his last season, 34. Damian Easley came off the bench. He was 37. Jose Valentin was there. He was 37.
I believe Julio Franco on that team, too.
Julio Franco, yeah. This was his second year, was 48 years old.
Came back to the Mets at 48 after leaving when he was 46 to go play for the Blue Jays or something, right?
Exactly. They also, wow, at different times had Jeff Conine, 41, Mike DeFelice, 38, Sandy Alomar, 41. I did not remember.
Junior.
Yeah. Not his dad. Yeah, exactly. And Tom Glavine was 41. El Duque was 41. Billy Wagner, the closer, was 35. And Pedro Martinez, who was hurt for all of about 5 starts, was 35. Chanho Park, 34. I guess he counts. This was an ancient, ancient team. They had so many guys retire off of this team. It was like a class graduated to oblivion, basically.
Yeah, it was remarkable. Because they had, I mean, the year before, they looked like they could have won the World Series. I mean, they didn't. They Mets'd it in the playoffs. And, you know, I'm still working on getting over it. But it is, but yeah, it was like as soon as that, when it didn't work out, and suddenly you're realizing that you're basically just like paying the cast of 30 something to come around and give up doubles to the Cardinals. Like they've done this a lot. I mean, I think that beyond having this taste for old guys and veterans that they have historically, and then I think especially recently, just again, because they're cheap, neglected the upper minors in a way that they get every now and then. There'll be like a Josh Satin or somebody that they call up who seems like a career minor leaguer that like actually helps them for a little bit, but they tend disproportionately to err on the side of like signing fucking Joseph Bats or like Adrian Gonzalez or Jose Reyes, who are the three guys that I think are the most of that Mets vintage that are on the roster now. I mean, it says something that this would be the research that I really would have wanted to do would be like guys over 30 who had their last major league plate appearance with the Mets or their last pitching appearance with the Mets. And I think that it may not be true that it is like disproportionately high. When I tweeted that, some people were like, the Giants do this a lot. Other people pointed out that the Yankees have like low-key historically been pretty good at this as well. But for the Mets, it's been a constant, really, as you identify, going back to the very first teams when they were, you know, they didn't have good players. They were an expansion team. But what they could give you was like, you remember Willie Mays? You remember Richie Ashburn? You remember Warren Spahn? Like, they're all here, you know? And it's like one of those kind of sad concerts that you see advertised for, like, you know, Boys to Men is playing at like a, you know, the Barclays Center, and they're all in their 50s. But like, you know, apparently they can still sing. That was not the case with like Warren Spahn as a Met. But
Duke Snider, Gil Hodges, it's a long list. Yeah. Of guys from back then that, yeah, like, hey, let's try this. You remember them fondly. I had an ad for one of those concert tours that's basically like coming through my front yard in the summer. There are a couple of them, and somehow the Turtles are always part of it.
Yeah, I guess they're just healthy. Like, those guys all do like Soul Cycle or something like that, so they're like able to play their songs. But
I love the ones where the band is literally dead, and it's like Badfinger featuring, if you remembered the names of Badfinger, you would not remember this guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, Badfinger had some great songs, but unfortunately a couple of them took a premature exit out, and you're not getting that.
Right. Like, if you want to hear those songs, like, they're available elsewhere. You don't need to go someplace and watch, like, their nephews do it or whatever. I know that's, like, the way it is with, like, Foreigner and Lou Gramm at this point, that they're just, like, cross the country every summer at different state fairs, where it's like maybe you get like Lou Gramm playing Foreigner songs, or you get the members of Foreigner without Lou Gramm playing Foreigner songs, but you will never get the two of them together.
Right. And, you know, there was a whole thing, and again, this is way off topic, but there was a whole thing just a few weeks back when
Lou Gramm, or because is that what we're talking about now?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that subject contains depths and depths. When the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing happened, they inducted Dire Straits. The Mark Knopfler didn't show up, and his brother didn't show up, which left kind of the rump legislature of the band.
How embarrassing. Yeah,
you know, three guys, you know, the utility infielders of Dire Straits, who inducted themselves.
Nice.
Because no one would induct them, not having the front men be there. But you know that there is a package tour waiting where they will say, like, you know, Dire Straits featuring John Eggs and Bobby Hamm and whatever. And it, no, there's no Mark Knopfler. They'll get some ringer to actually do the stuff, but you'll pay, maybe not you, maybe not me, but somebody pays for that.
You know, the most inspiring version of this story, you may already know about this. It only involves bad bands from the late 70s and early 80s, sadly. I think this is really like the absolute nadir of taste level. Like, Dire Straits may be like too tasteful to do this. You know that who's singing for Journey now? That like Steve Perry's not doing it?
No.
So they got a guy, it's another one of those situations where like Steve Perry tours by himself and Journey tours by themselves since they hate each other. The dude that they have singing for them now sounds remarkably like Steve Perry. He is a Filipino karaoke champ, like from the Philippines guy, who was so good at karaoke that they basically like saw a video of him singing like Faithfully or something like that. And we're like, holy shit, could this possibly be real? When he joined the band, really didn't speak very much English, but he knew all of their songs inside and out. He could do like a perfect, like basically like not just like a version, but like almost like a recitation of the canonic versions. And so like they just tour with that guy now.
This is remarkably similar, and this too is based on a true story. I'm going to demonstrate a far better recall of this movie than I should. There is a really dire Mark Wahlberg
rock star
in which his struggle is that his cover band, which covers sort of a fictional hair metal band called Steel Dragons or something, they want to play originals, but no, Mark Wahlberg's character is going to stay true to being an imitator, which is the weirdest struggle. You could make a Vincent van Gogh movie. No, I must paint like myself.
Yeah.
No one understands me. I have to be like somebody else.
It's such a Bush era fantasy. It's perfect. It never occurred until you were reciting the plot that that's exactly what it is. That like our hero is the guy that's like, look, you guys can make up your own songs and express yourselves all you like. As far as I'm concerned, like the last good song was written in 1982 and I know all the words to it. Like, it's just, that's the whole deal.
I'm going to sing that song and that song only in small bars around this country. Oh my gosh. Yes.
I'm not a hero. I'm just a man who knows what he believes.
I see Sylvester Stallone in this somehow.
Yeah.
Even though the one singing Sylvester Stallone movie, and there is one, it's his team up with Dolly Parton. It's the name of it is escaping me.
Right?
Yes, Rhinestone is egregiously bad, but worth a hate watch somewhere. As Sylvester Stallone sings his big country anthem, Drinkenstein.
Oh.
It's
also such 80s Mad Libs too, where they're just like, it's a like type of movie and you're like musical, and then it's like starring, and then it's like singer who doesn't act very much and action movie guy. And you, like, it could have been made with like whatever, Linda Ronstadt and Steven Seagal. We probably got the better version of it. but
I will say, vis-a-vis the Mets signing Jose Bautista, that the shelves are clean out of outfielders. And yeah, they're putting a 37-year-old guy who seems to be kind of past it out there. But when the alternative is running utility infielder Philip Evans out there one more time, or some other kind of fraud, basically, I guess I'd rather see Jose Bautista get an audition.
Oh yeah, I don't have a problem with it. I mean, it's the sort of move that teams make over the course of a season. The Mets just seem to make them almost as like kind of a tick. Like when Rick Ankiel was a Met, it wasn't like he was taking at bats away from better players. It was that like Rick Ankiel was available and their AAA team was, you know, bare. All due respect to Val Pascucci, of course, but he's not a center fielder. And in this case, I feel like it's the sort of thing where like either he or Jose Reyes is probably going to lose their roster spot when Todd Frazier comes back from the DL. And like, that's fine. They probably both deserve it. But what's hard about it, you know, just in terms of caring about the Mets, is that there's usually some guy who is being blocked by these dudes, or the manager. For a while with Terry Collins, I thought it was sort of endemic to him. But Mickey Callaway does the same thing, where they have this tendency to rely on veterans whose only real attribute that could be considered a recommendation is the fact that they played in the majors a long time. And the Mets, especially the Wilpon way, I think has this kind of like folkloric, like sports talk radio approach to player evaluation, where the idea that like, if someone has been on the Mets before, then the Wilpons believe he can cut it in New York or whatever. And that's like the argument for why they tend to bring guys back, even guys that are like pretty well past it. The idea of like, you know, Julio Franco had an amazing career and was a great talent, but the idea that he was really, that a 48-year-old dude was the best option to be like a part-time first baseman when you had an injury-prone 35-year-old there, like that can't possibly have been true. And yet, like, that's certainly the way that the Wilpons would have seen it. They'd be like, oh, he was here a couple of years ago. He did great. We made the playoffs.
Well, the real risk of that philosophy, and this is something that the Yankees found throughout the 1980s as well. As you said, the Yankees were incredibly addicted to veterans because George Steinbrenner did feel that young players spit the bit and couldn't cut it in New York until they had somehow proved it by playing in Philadelphia, which makes no damn sense, you know?
It's like, unreal.
But
like, show me you can do it, and then I'll bring you back at a much higher cost.
Right. And at a much shorter shelf life. And so the point is that when you have the Mets just as they are now, and some of this is not going to seem, this is not as old as that 2007 team, but you have Adrian Gonzalez, 36, Asdrubal Cabrera, 32, Todd Frazier, 32, Cespedes, 32, and onward, Jay Bruce, 31. And the thing is that some of those guys, because they're old, will get hurt. Some of them, because they're old, will age out sooner than you expect. And if you don't have the depth to replace them, and the very fact that you sign them suggests that you don't have the depth to replace them, you are going to kind of have your team coming and going at the same time.
Yeah.
And
especially they have these artificial budget constraints put on by the ownership too. So you only, right. you narrow your chances of getting it right in two ways. Because as you pointed out, it's like these guys do tend to break. And then also because of the fact that you were like, well, I don't know, we already paid an outfielder. Like, we can't pay another outfielder. I'm sorry. That's how it is.
That's a lot like, you know, the chicken in the refrigerator is like a month past its sell-by date, but we spent the money, damn it.
Right.
So that we are frying that sucker for dinner tonight. Botulism be damned.
Yeah, which is that is extremely on point, and right down to the fact that it causes me discomfort in my midsection. The Bruce signing was especially weird because they actually do have guys that could, I mean, Michael Conforto, who they've had a baffling lack of faith in all through his young career with the team, where he's done basically nothing but hit, and they have moved him around and sat him for multiple days, and he's had slumps and stuff like that. But that guy's your right fielder. And then Brandon Nimmo, if you believe in him, could be, you know, your center fielder with Juan Lagares or whatever. But then you plug in, you know, Bruce was like the one guy they really paid this offseason, him and Jason Vargas. And in both of those cases, it seemed like, I mean, the best argument for signing Bruce is that, especially when you are a team that has serious holes at first base at that time, also at third base, like the idea of signing him is just that, like, well, he was here before. Like, we actually still have some jerseys with his name on the back. Like, let's see what's, you know, but him ahead of other guys. I mean, like, I like Jay Bruce too. I think he's been like a good Met. He's like a limited player in some ways, but he tries his ass off and he's like a decent person. But like, no, I mean, why? Other than the, you know, the obvious reason, which is a silly one.
I just want to throw out there to relieve the gastric distress that I inflicted on you with that analogy that, and this causes problems in my marriage, and it may cause problems in yours. So just be warned. But my way of protecting myself from that kind of situation is that my wife goes to supermarkets and high-end stores and buys wonderful gourmet stuff to have around the house. My law is I assume that anything that has been in the refrigerator for more than 24 hours has actually been there for 6 months. So
that was very much the way it was when I was growing up. And my parents would always like bust me because I would like check the expiration date on the milk or like smell it. And they'd be like, oh, you know, you're paranoid, whatever. And like, the thing is, like, one time in three, it was just like, because they would go and somehow like just buy like three cartons of milk, all of which expired at the same time for no reason. Like, I still don't understand their grocery strategy. I've given up trying to change it. But there are a lot of like sort of like suspiciously active looking like blobs of mozzarella there. Where I'm just like, it's moved. Like, I don't know how it moved, but it's certainly like slightly to the right of where it was when last I looked in this drawer. Like, you should get that looked at.
Right. But, right, like a mole.
Right, like, like metastatic cheeses. You don't want that.
You know what it is? It's that one package of mozzarella looks much like another. And so it may be that the old one has actually gone away and been replaced by another that's new. But since they're identical, you have no way of distinguishing it. They really should be able to tell you, no, I am not the old cheese. I am the new cheese.
Right.
Which may be a Pete Townsend lyric.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I was going to say, like, it's kind of, it's beautiful in some ways. Like, I would read, like, if I were a kid, I would read a young adult novel by that name.
Meet the old cheese, not the new cheese. If yet my latest career initiatives don't work, that's next. We can collaborate on that. So we could talk about the Mets indefinitely, but since we can't, because the internet has limited bites, I wanted to bring this up, and I want to bring up this topic in a slightly off-center way, but I want to make this almost a biblical issue. And that is that if you read the Old Testament, and I know you do constantly as part of your rabbinic studies.
Several times a year at the synagogue where I was bar mitzvah, I read it, yes.
You go back, like the swallows returning to Capistrano. You're hoping that there was a check that was dropped that's been under the cushions all this time. No one found it.
Fred gave me 60 bucks.
That bastard. What am I supposed to do with this, Fred? I mean, even in $1990 or whatever it was, you can't do a whole lot with that. But in Leviticus, it says you shall not have graven images. You shall not bow down before statues. This is the famous proscription against idolatry. And religious scholars debate why that's so. But I think the most obvious answer is that when you have a divine being who's supposed to be ineffable, that for him to have no boundaries is essential, he or she, I should say, to their grip on the imagination. It is inevitably reductive to draw a stick figure and put a beard and a halo on it and call it God. Well, similarly, a song can be, and now you know where I'm going, can be an idol, and the song has no more meaning than what you give it. And if you reduce the whole act of patriotism to standing or sitting for a song, then you have also done something reductive in the way that the ancient uptight guys who wrote the Bible were counseling against. yesterday. This we're talking on a Thursday. This was Wednesday. The NFL came out with a new policy on kneeling for the national anthem, the protests. There will be no more protests. If you want to sit the thing out, if you're a player, you can hang out in the locker room. I look forward to post games where reporters say, "Where were you during the national anthem, oh, Bob?" And Bob
Trump's
says,
"Trump's already doing it.
I was in the bathroom."
Yeah.
That's going to be awkward. But yes, and Trump said, maybe if you protest the anthem, you don't deserve to be in this country. And the question is, who are we saying should be deported now? And similarly, Mike Pence yesterday, when this news came out, tweeted "winning" in big letters. And I thought, who are we winning over? What is it that we're winning exactly? What battle is this that we're fighting? And in both cases, it seems to be that we have defeated black people. Essentially, they're the ones who are doing the protest. That rather than listening to what they have to say, maybe empathizing and working towards some kind of solution, instead we will demonize the protest itself and come up with an absurd rule that only makes the situation worse.
Well, Stephen, I think you're right. I think that in this case, that is, seems clear to me that that's what it is. It's like the last issue that Trump's really got. Like, his attention span and aptitude for the job are insufficient for the demands of that job, and he can't do any of the difficult stuff. But he's been doing this shit for as long as people have put dictaphones in his face. That, like, the guy knows how to, whatever, like, demonize a thug. That's like basically his only skill. And the idea that so many people are susceptible to it, to me, is, you know, depressing. But at this point, like, that's clear. I think that there's of that last generation of diehards to which he belongs, that there's a real preference for that sort of theater over almost anything else. I think that people would rather be offended by the NFL than watch it at this point. And I think a lot of those people maybe are making that choice, or maybe they're just doing both. Maybe they're watching football and realizing that they just can't stand the fact that there's so many black guys playing it. And then here comes this other dude to tell them what it's about. I understand that people take the anthem and the flag seriously. I mean, they are meaningful to me as far as they go, but I feel like the idea that the protest has been about disrespecting or somehow transgressing against the flag, as opposed to the transgressions and the acts of disrespect under that flag that have been visited upon this population for so long. Like, it's, they've been saying it for as long as this protest has been happening. The idea, like, at some point, I think you just don't get to say that you don't know what it's about anymore. I mean, like, you would, if all you did was watch cable news, if all you did was watch Fox News, which is, I think, for Trump, is the entirety of where he gets his information, beyond like talking to his friends on the phone, then, like, you authentically wouldn't know what they're protesting. But otherwise, you really, it's on you if you don't have some sense of what this is about at this point.
Right. And it is what it is. It's not talking about, and it has no bearing or reference or disrespect for the guys who went ashore on D-Day or all those guys who died unnecessarily in Vietnam. Like, I mean, if you, that's its own category. Of course we respect those guys. And if I can say we in this instance, everybody respects those guys. Everybody who did something or service to the country is respected. That's not what this is saying. This is just saying, think. That's all it's really saying. And you make it both more and less than what it is when you try to compel a respect for something. That by itself is a contradiction in terms.
Yeah.
Love is sweeping the country. Waves are hugging the shore. All the sexes from Maine to Texas have never known such love before. See them billing and cooing like the birdies above. Each girl and boy alike sharing joy alike feel that passional, soon be national. Love is sweeping the country. There never was so much love.
George and Ira Gershwin wrote the song Love is Sweeping the Country for their 1931 Pulitzer Prize-winning Broadway play, book by George S. Kaufman and Maury Riskin, of The I Sing, and Nat King Cole performed it on TV in the 1950s. That's what's happening, right? We'll take a break for a word from our sponsors, and then we'll be back to wrap up our conversation with David Roth.
It's also just the sort of thing where, like, a lot of the more anodyne statements that you see on it are, like, are, you know, obviously an anodyne statement's an anodyne statement, so it's, you can read it any number of ways. But the one I'm thinking of, I'm looking at it right now, John Harbaugh said earlier today, the coach of the Ravens, "I believe in standing for the flag. To me, the flag represents the ideas and the ideals that make us America." Then he goes on to say some more completely circular sentences. Like, that is, to me, like, beyond the "I believe in standing for the flag" thing, like, sure, good for you. The idea that, like, the flag represents the ideas and the ideals that make us America, like, is not the most meaningful statement in the world, but it's also not meaningless. I mean, that is the sort of thing where, like, if you believe that to be true, and you believe that the ideas and ideals that make us America are important, then, like, you owe it to yourself to do a little bit of work to see that those things are borne out, or to see that, like, that it's more than just, like, sort of a symbol that represents a symbol. Like, this is a moving target. It's a living thing, the country. Right. And the idea that, like, these people are saying to you, like, the ideas and the ideals that make us America are, like, things that I aspire to too, but I'm being prevented from being able to enjoy for no good reason. Like, that should make you madder than the fact that they're pointing it out. I just don't understand the point of view otherwise, that, you know, it's somehow more offensive to notice than to, you know, be forced to suffer it.
Well, it's almost like asking for a blind faith. And for some people, that is the meaning of faith, that you do not investigate what it is that you're doing. You just reflexively do it. And that's asking a lot of people to basically check their brains, especially when they're seeing people who look like them murdered in the streets. And I know it's provocative for me to say it that way, but if you do believe in the United States and the country that it supposedly is, then due process is a thing that you at least have to pretend exists. And every time, I'm not trying to impugn law enforcement. I'm a big fan of the police, obviously. I hope they come when I call them if I need them. It's not that. It's that every time, whether for a good reason or a bad reason, someone is shot down by a police officer, we've had a failure of due process. And again, it could be that there was no other choice. Like, that was the right thing to do in that moment. But if you believe in some of these American values, the freedom of speech, due process, and so on, you at least have to ask every single time, did we live up to our own standards when that happened? And at that point, what some of the people who are protesting are saying, and those of us who empathize with the protest are saying, we're not always doing that investigation, or when we do that investigation, the answers are troubling at best. That is, it says in the beginning of the Constitution, the preamble, in order to form a more perfect union, that is asking questions that should be asked in order to push us towards a more perfect union. That's something everybody should be a fan of, not something that should be offensive.
Well, certainly the idea of hearing the question seems very offensive to a lot of people. And I understand that only to the extent that I can say that from my own experience, you know, which is comparatively sheltered. I mean, like, I'm a white passing Jewish person that lives in a big city, you know, and like the idea, like none of that to me is, you know, like my experience has been my experience, I guess is what I'm saying. The idea that other people have it a lot worse and that they don't deserve it and that the system is built to make sure that it stays that way is upsetting, you know, it's concerning and it's saddening or whatever. And it's not a fun thing to think about. And so I understand why it would be the sort of thing that, you know, these people would be upset to be asked to think about. But I don't think that that's reason not to do it or to respond so hysterically in the other direction about being like the idea that somehow a protest is more offensive than the thing it's protesting.
That's a very strange and circular thing, and yet that's always what we've done in this country. And you can go back to things like the Red Scare, where the either one of them, there were two big ones, one in about 1920 and then the other in the 50s, obviously the Joe McCarthy period, where they made the very fact that one was protesting equal to disloyalty. And it ain't necessarily so. Sometimes it is. There are really people who are disloyal. There's no doubt about that. But it's a great way of demonizing the questioner and not responding to the question.
Yeah, it's just a way of creating a new group of people that can be dismissed. I mean, and that's the real Trumpy touch, is that he's always finding some new target of, you know, whatever, like the idea of it being immigrants or being black people or being, you know, or even like being fucking gang members that you call animals or whatever. I mean, it's like, obviously this is not a pro MS-13 baseball podcast, but the idea, although of course that's a great idea. But the idea of like just finding some new group of people to like read out of the in-group of humanity so that they can be, you know, whatever, you can just kick them around to your heart's content and know that they're not you. I mean, that's the story of race in this country. It's something that we apparently have made zero progress on, actually, in terms of like sorting out in our heads, as opposed to like having sort of kludgy administrative attempts to remedy it. That's been the part, I mean, of the last few years, I think, is when you spend some time thinking about it, that's most painful to consider, is just the idea that, you know, we're not near to solving this.
To bring this back to sports for a sec, and it,
yes,
is,
please,
no, it,
please,
is, it is sports, unfortunately. But I feel 2 points for you to respond to. One, I feel a bit strange about having super competent people like the owners of the Cleveland Browns tell other people how to run their lives. That seems like a very odd thing to me.
Yeah.
And
like guys that I would not let parallel park for me. The idea that they get to dictate a policy of free speech. It's not,
it shouldn't be this difficult. And then the other part, and I'm not the first person to bring this up, but what does the national anthem have to do with football or baseball or anything to begin with? I mean, maybe if we're going to borrow from the ancient movie War Games, if we're going to play a game of global thermonuclear war, maybe you want everybody to listen to the anthem before we go off and play that one. But otherwise, it's really just something that got tacked on intermittently going back to the beginnings of, in particularly in baseball, the beginnings of the game, and then really only set in kind of a metastatic way after World War II. And then we got the affliction that is God Bless America after 9/11. And again, it's not about patriotism. It's about phony ritual that has absolutely nothing to do with Mike Trout or, for that matter, Jose Bautista or anybody.
And that was a large part of that, too, in the NFL. Like, this is, the NFL always finds a way to make the subtext textual. That's what they do. For them, a lot of this goes back to stuff that, you know, was later revealed in an investigation, that they were charging the United States Army for flyovers and free advertising during games. The idea of having players on the sidelines was not mandatory in the NFL until 2007. And it was the sort of thing that clearly was a part of a staged spectacle that they were doing for a sponsor. They say that they stopped charging the U.S. government for the right to have a bunch of Marines holding a large flag on the field. But at the same time, the broader part of it the point that you made about God Bless America, like none of this stuff ever goes back in the bottle, you know, that like once you decide that this sort of patriotic spectacle is a part of your sport, you can never say that it's not and just be like, oh, well, we solved that problem. Like, we're just going to play football now. Like, once it's in there, it's in there. And then the rest of it is just there to be demagogued and exploited by people bored enough and stupid enough to do it. That guy has the nuclear codes now. So,
and he also thinks the concussion thing is overstated. So all around, a guy you want to be listening to when it comes to sports.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he doesn't know anything. I mean, like, you can't like really. That's the part of it that, like, I think of all the things that you can sort of find offensive about him in terms of what he actually thinks and the violation of norms or whatever. I mean, all of which is bad. The fact that he hasn't ever bothered to try to learn anything in nearly 2 years on the job is astonishing to me. that like really it's just still watching TV and like talking to his buddies on the phone. That like this whole apparatus is there. He could figure this stuff out if he wanted to, but he just it's more work than he feels like doing. It's boring.
So we just have a couple of minutes left, and before you go off on other errands, let me just ask real fast before we close here to come back to baseball once again. And again, everything is baseball. Baseball is everything. So I'm not apologizing for any of the ground that we've covered. What about this season so far? And we're a little over a quarter of the way, getting on a third of the way through it. Have you enjoyed the most so far?
That's an easy one to answer. Whatever it is that Shohei Ohtani is going to be is actually going to be cooler, I think, than what I thought he was going to be. I can't believe how fucking badass that guy is. Are you also enjoying that?
I am. And, you know, I didn't realize how existential it was, my enjoyment of it, until I read a piece by Sam Miller at ESPN the other day, in which he pointed out just how wonderfully everything has worked out. And I think all of us can remember, whether it's a birthday or Hanukkah or Christmas or whatever, that you get, well, a $60 check. But I mean, you get this present that, you know, the commercial said, you know, was like G.I. Joe, but he's actually alive and he can kill your enemies and you can play with him on land, sea, air. And it just sits there, right? But this is the gift that we were promised. He hits, he pitches, he does everything. He does.
I know. That's the part of it that's amazing, is that like the – because I mean, I wrote about him a couple times before the season, and I will admit, like, I thought probably hyperbolic, but certainly, like, I was wish casting. I was like, you know, I want to see a thing that I've never seen before, and I hope that it is cool. And, you know, it is as good as I think he is as good as I could have imagined him being. And the fact that it's all that, like, we're actually seeing things for the first time, the idea of this dude, like, popping off and hitting homers and then the next day coming out and like three hitting some team. Like that is, it's just fucking wild. Very few people alive have ever seen stuff like that.
No, it's true. It's, you've got to go back to Babe Ruth, basically. I mean, it's been a long time and there are good reasons for that, that the game as it gets more complex calls for specialization. But this kid, he's only 23. If we're really lucky, we could get 10 or 12 or 15 years of that. I don't think we'll be that lucky. And we're still in small sample territory. So there's a little thing in the back of my mind that says, like, basically curb your enthusiasm. But still, I mean, as long as it lasts, it's a great thing.
Even if he doesn't, you know, really develop much as a hitter and stays sort of like a, you know, a guy that hits some homers and, you know, like a decent enough DH, if he's like a CJ Crone, but also if he, I think the pitching stuff to me seems undeniable. I don't see any reason why, you know, barring injury, of course, like why that should decline. Like it seems that it was always the, what the scouts said about him before too, right? Was it like the hit tool was a little bit more suspect than the pitching, and the pitching was basically as close to a layup as you could imagine. I guess the key is managing him, but again, like nobody knows what the fuck to do. Like this has never happened before. And so I guess right now is probably looking at like 20 starts and 400 plate appearances on the season or something like that. And like, that's a lot. I don't know if that's the max. I don't know if that's the baseline, but like, it's cool. He's 23. Like we don't know yet.
Well, like I said, I think that's Babe Ruth 1918 or 1919 or something like that. And that's just fine. Thanks. I'll take that.
Yeah, sure. Like if that was the part of it that was crazy when I was writing about it too, where it's like I know that like the people I know that are like scoutier people are like, you don't comp Pedro, like it's just not done,
right?
It's considered rude to compare somebody to that. The idea of someone's actual best scouting comp being fucking Babe Ruth is like just wonderful, but also not something that I would have ever expected. Like, you know, nobody's like, yeah, like he's got a kind of like a Mickey Mantle Shinsu Chu thing going on. Like there's just players that don't get compared to other players, and you know, here we are.
Right. And he'll theoretically take better care of himself than Babe Ruth or Mickey Mantle and possibly Shinsu Chu for that matter. So
yeah, seriously, like the idea of, I mean, certainly Babe Ruth, I think by the time he died was mostly hot dog meat. Like he had just become a hot dog. Whereas, yeah, I mean, Ohtani, whatever, it'll be cool to see what happens with that. I'm enjoying the season so far. The Mets have not made me happy necessarily, but I'm digging the Yanks way more than I would have thought possible for me. Do you have a non-Ohtani answer for like what is delighting you?
This is going to sound weird. It's the Orioles and Reds, because I root for excellence And Ohtani is one kind of excellence, and losing 75% of your baseball games is another kind of excellence. It's a bad excellence, but in its own way, it's the perfection of bad. And I think that that's really, really neat. So every day, I'm very disappointed right now in this moment because the Orioles are playing the White Sox, who are another team on that list, which means someone has to win. But on all other days, when those teams lose, I feel like it's DiMaggio's hitting streak all over again. If DiMaggio always went 0-for-5,
yeah, the Reds had a period they beat the Mets. They say maybe swept the Mets and then took the Dodgers 2 out of 3, or the other way around. And I was like, there's no way that they can keep this up. Not the winning. Like, I was like, I knew that they couldn't continue to lose like 17 out of 20 games. Like, it's just, they don't have it in them. They're not an all-timer. Like,
no, I mean, and when they win, it's like they've failed the nihilism league. It's this weird backwards incentive that is perverse, but I enjoy the heck out of it. David, I don't want to make you late for your next amazing in Denver. In Denver, your next.
I'm going to Denver. Yes, I've been called up. It's a big moment for me. I'm getting Jamie Carroll's locker.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're pitching in that park, not hitting in it. But anyway, I thank you very much for coming by. I look forward to the next time you're up in the rotation. I've learned a great deal, as always.
Right on, man. Same. Have a good one.
By Johnny Bench's baleful bucket of buckyballs, we have reached the end of another show. You can follow David Roth on Twitter at David_J_Roth. I hear tell in some cultures underscore is synonymous with sexy. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because when it was Go Fish Stephen Goldman, people kept bringing me plates of flounder, and I dislike flounder. You can also write us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. There's a Facebook group. Just search for Infinite Inning on that old Facebook and you'll find us. And please rate us. Rate us at Apple iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. And if the podcatcher of your choice doesn't allow it, write it on a bathroom wall somewhere. I can use all the help I can get. We have a sponsor now, but you guessed it. Nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 17. Our producer is Effluvium J. Cornwall. Our theme song, which you are listening to now and have in fact been hearing throughout the episode, was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. Dr. Rick is presently on a beach somewhere. When we were in high school, there was this woman who wore a button every day that said, "Life's a beach and so am I." I still don't understand what that's supposed to mean or why it's something someone would say about oneself aside from the obvious pun. Well, if I don't draw the Monopoly card that says, "Do not pass go, do not collect $200, but proceed directly to the Slough of Despond, where I will sink slowly into the bog while making more references to books I haven't read," I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.